The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guests on Off the Shelf are Jay Carey and Luke Meyer. They are attorneys at McKenna Long & Aldridge and focusing on government contracts and also, as part of government contracts, bid protests. And that's our topic today. We're going to talk about the world of bid protests, the current trends, stats, key issues that protesters need, and awardees and the government need to think about. So I'm looking forward to the conversation. And Jay and Luke, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Roger. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, this is one of those areas that, I think there's a love-hate relationship, right, I think, with bid protests.
Yeah, it depends which side you're on at the moment.
Yeah. Right, yeah. It always depends. But if people don't like them if they're the awardee, but at the same time, the opportunity to be able to challenge or at least ask the government to explain why it made a particular decision a particular way. It's part of our system for many, many years. But there is some angst out there in terms of, there's a lot of talk about the number of protests filed. Has there been a, quote, explosion in bid protests? And I think we're going to talk about that right now. But first, Jay, let's look at last year, fiscal year 2014, in terms of the number of bid protests filed and what happened at the Government Accountability Office.
Yeah, thanks, Roger. So every October, GAO publishes its annual report on the most statistics for the most recent fiscal year. And there are a few stats of note from last year's report. One is, of course, the overall number of cases filed, which clocked in at 2,561, which is what I will call a modern high. As we'll see, I think in a little bit, it's certainly not an all-time high,
but it
is a modern high. And I think that's fueling some of what you're mentioning in terms of angst. And that's continued a steady upward trend in protest that's been ongoing for the last 14, 15 years. A couple other numbers of note that probably would jump out to anyone who takes a look at the report. One is the sustain rate, which was 13%. And that kind of stands out in the GAO report because the last number of years, the sustain rate has hovered between about 16 to 19%. And so 13% is significantly lower than it has been in past years. Although, a couple comments on that. It's hard to tell whether it's a one-year blip. There have been one-year blips like that in the past. But more importantly, it's really important for anyone looking at these stats to look not just at the sustain rate, but also at the effectiveness rate. And just a few words about, what is the effectiveness rate?
Yeah, you read my mind. Yeah. What is the effectiveness rate, Jay?
So fundamentally, the effectiveness rate is the percentage of cases in which the protester gets some form of relief, regardless of whether that relief is as a result of a sustain by GAO or as a result of voluntary corrective action by the agency. Because, of course, if the agency sees the protest and agrees or has concerns, it can choose to address those concerns on its own without waiting for a sustain.
And the effectiveness rate for 2014 is
43%, which is really right in line with where it has been for the last number of years. For the last 5 years, it's been 42 or 43%. So what that tells us when we look at that rate in conjunction with the 13% sustain rate, it tells us that, or it strongly suggests, that agencies maybe are doing a better job of predicting which protests will be sustained by GAO and acting proactively to take corrective action before they ever get to an adverse decision by GAO. So, you know, there's some good news there for everybody, I think. On the protester front, there's still the same overall chance of and likelihood of success in the protest forum. On the agency front, I think the good news there is that they're doing a better and better job at predicting which protests are likely to be upheld as meritorious and taking early action to deal with those.
So agencies are figuring out sooner, you know, the merits of the case, making, you know, legal/business decisions to take corrective action. And why is that so important? I mean, I know it shows the effectiveness rate is essentially consistent, but for agencies and protesters, you know, taking that corrective action early, what are the implications for that for the agency in terms of, let's say, bid protest costs and for a protester? Don't they have to do it before the filing of the report? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So from the agency's perspective, if the agency takes corrective action before it files the agency report, which, of course, the agency report in the vast majority of protests is due 30 days after the protest is filed. If the agency takes corrective action before filing that report, then it is not responsible for the protester's protest costs. If it takes corrective action after it files the report, it can be responsible for reasonable protest costs associated with meritorious protest claims. So there is a real incentive on that front. And even above and beyond that, where you have an agency who is, of course, when a GAO protest is filed within certain timelines, it triggers a statutory stay. And by taking corrective action, the agency, by taking it early, the agency is able to get the procurement back on track faster and get to a new award. And meanwhile, in a lot of situations where there's a protest, in order to get the services or the supplies during the pendency of the protest process, the agency is issuing a sole source bridge contract, which is usually less competitive. So the faster that they can get to their new award, it's usually a benefit to the agency.
Right. So so we have, you know, can you talk a little bit about, Luke, the trends over the last 4 years or so in terms of the number of protests filed? Jay mentioned it's an all-time high. You know, when did we start to see the growth in bid protests? I mean, and I put growth in quotes in terms of the current time frame, you know, over the last few years versus, because I can go back in ancient history, talk about the thousands of protests that used to be filed with a much smaller budget.
Sure. So there were, as you said, there was a time period when there were many more protests than even today. In the 1980s and into the early 1990s, it was as high as, you know, in 1993, it was 3,377. So it was, you know, far more than the 2,500 we saw last year. So one thing going on there is the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act was passed, which made some changes to the protest system.
And I think that was in 1994.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So one thing that did is it carved out task orders, and it said, but for a small, you know, few exceptional instances, you can't protest a task order. So by removing those from, you know, the procurement that could be protested right there, it cut out a significant number. And so, you know, there were many fewer right away. And, you know, there are other factors as well, but it got to kind of a low ebb in fiscal year 2001. But since that time, it's been a very steady, consistent increase in the number of protests each year. It's just continued to climb.
Right. Just to build on that, Roger, I mean, in the 90s, there were a few things going on. I mean, one was the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act. Another was the, you know, consolidation of the defense industry and some things that were happening with the defense budget. And as Luke mentioned, we reached this sort of modern low of 1146 in 2001. I'll just note that in 2001, that same year, the total federal contracting budget was about $223 billion, which is about a little more than half of where it is today. I think today, in 2014, the total contracting budget was $445 billion. So it's right about half. So when you look at protests on a rate basis, in 2001, there were a little more than five protests per $1 billion of contract spending. And last year, there were 5.75 protests per $1 billion of federal spending. So, you know, while it looks like it may look on the surface like there's been an explosion in protests, when you look at it on a rate basis, that really isn't true. It's been fairly stable, increasing with the amount of federal money that's being spent, which is not only natural, but as you mentioned, built into our system that we want a certain level of oversight of the procurement process, and I think that's keeping pace.
Right. So we do have to take our first break, but when we come back, I want to ask you a little bit about, you know, Luke, you mentioned the task order authority back in the day, 1994. You couldn't protest task orders except for something that was outside the scope of the contract, essentially, or exceeding the contract maximum, something like that. But now you can protest task orders valued over, I think, $10 million.
$10 million.
Yeah.
Right.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about what the impact has been in that as a result of that change in jurisdiction. And my guests today are Jay Carey and Luke Meyer, and they are attorneys at McKenna Long and Aldridge. And you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Jay Carey and Luke Meyer, who are attorneys at McKenna Long and Aldridge, and we're talking bid protests. In the first segment, we talked a lot about the stats out there and the number of protests filed, and I guess the number per billion of dollars, or was it $5 billion, something like that? You said,
about
Jay,
about five per $1 billion.
Right. Okay, yep. And it's when you look at it from that way, I guess there isn't. It's sort of a statistical norm, right? It's sort of has stayed steady state throughout. More dollars spent, there are more protests, but it's not somehow like protests have outstripped the spending, right?
Right. The rate has not exploded.
Right, right. Yeah. But the other aspect of it is kind of interesting, and Luke, you mentioned it in the first segment that, in the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act, the multi-board IDIQ contracting was essentially authorized, and it also, at the same time, prohibited protests except in very limited circumstances. Well, and I was part of the SARA panel. The SARA panel recommended that, you be able to protest task orders to the extent, made recommendations along those lines. Ultimately became law that you can protest task orders exceeding $10 million. So what happened with regard to task orders in 2014?
Sure. Yeah, and just to recount the history there, for several years, you couldn't protest a task order, as you said, except for saying it's out of scope. But then to have some accountability, especially on the huge task orders, the right was created to protest a task order exceeding $10 million only at the GAO, because you can protest normally either at the GAO or the Court of Federal Claims. So there is this limited ability to protest task orders that exceed $10 million at the GAO. And last year, there were about 300 protests of that kind, challenging a task order that exceeded that amount. So it is a significant number of the protests that GAO hears. And that also gives you a picture for how often agencies use task orders for substantial procurements.
Yeah, that's pretty. 300 out of 2,500, that's like about 15% or so, something like that.
I think that's
right. Do my math off the top of my head.
20%.
Yeah. So,
15%.
Yeah. So, what have you seen in your practice in terms of the impact that's had on, I guess the procurement market and the administration of those task order contracts?
Well, I think we've seen a few things. I mean, our anecdotal experience is very much consistent with the numbers. I mean, we see a good number of our protest practice involves task order protests. Both, we represent both protesters and intervener awardees. So it is very, our experience is very consistent with the numbers.
Right. And one area too, I ask is the protest grounds in a task order, are they much like a negotiated Part 15 procurement? Is that one of the key issues that is going on there? That, you know, they've made the task order competitions in some sense as complex as awarding a contract. Mm-hmm. Therefore, that's, you know, for guys like you out there looking and helping your clients, there's plenty of opportunities, right?
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, there are a couple things going on that are interesting in that vein. One is, of course, I mean, the government's use of IDIQ vehicles, that multiple award contract vehicles under which task orders are awarded has really, I think, exploded, which contributed directly to the creation of this new jurisdiction. And leads directly to the frequency with which we now see these protests. In addition to that, to your point about, you know, do the same rules apply? Well, they do and they don't. And that's an area that companies who are, you know, both protesters and intervener awardees and agencies for that matter, need to be aware of. A task order award is not a FAR Part 15 award. Which means that some of the very clear black and white rules in FAR Part 15 around, for example, discussions, don't clearly apply to the letter as they would to FAR Part 15. There's a line of GAO cases that says, essentially, if you run it like a FAR Part 15 procurement, we're going to look to those rules for guidance. But there's always been some ambiguity about how far that goes. And fundamentally, the standard that GAO looks like...
Ambiguity at GAO? No, come on now. Come on!
Never. And fundamentally, the standard that GAO looks at, and I think the court, there are some cases before the Court of Federal Claims where the court has looked at it through a similar lens, is has the agency treated all offers fairly and equitably, which is, you know, that's a very broad-based standard subject to interpretation, whereas in FAR Part 15, as we all know, the rules around discussions are very detailed.
Right.
Another practical difference is with the task order procurements, the government has a lower threshold for the amount of information they're required to share at the debriefing. So if you've got a Part 15 procurement, usually, you know, the protester is going to go to a debriefing. They're going to have quite a bit of information about how they were evaluated and why they weren't selected. But the agency is not required to share that much in a task order procurement. So sometimes if the agency doesn't elect to share more than necessary, the protester has far less information going into the protest. So, you know, that creates a slightly different dynamic sometimes.
And right. That's really true of the FAR Part 8.4 procurements, basically yeah. The orders under GSA schedules. That I think is even more where that becomes a real challenge.
Right. Well, you know, we used to, you know, protests of GSA schedule orders have always existed, mm-hmm. you know, for any size dollar value or for any reason, theoretically. And it's interesting, the more that bigger task orders or delivery orders being competed under the GSA schedules. You know, GSA, we used to tell them all the time, to your point earlier, you know, don't apply Part 15. Because if you apply Part 15, GAO's likely to use that FAR Part 15 lens to evaluate your actions as an agency and whether you know, treated everybody fairly, for lack of... So that's kind of interesting. So... You know, I want to turn to some of the specific cases, but we got about 2 minutes left in this segment. So why don't we just sum it up by, you know, I want to get your guys' take on what are the key factors affecting the, you know, the historical trends we are seeing with, there are more protests, there's more procurement going on at the same time, but, you know, in terms of statistically, actually, and you go back, you really made me feel bad and age me when you start talking about the 1980s and 1993, there were lots and lots of protests back then.
There
I can remember working at GSA and, you know, the logbook we had and the number of protests we got each year, you know, it was a long one. I mean, in the hundreds.
Yep.
So what do you see are the, you know, currently the trends that are shaping, you know, the bid protest world as we speak in terms of number of filings and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I think we've talked about a few, and I'll mention a few others. So we've talked about task order jurisdiction. That clearly is having an effect. In addition, the growth of the federal budget we talked about. I would also throw in there, at least in the period from 2008 up through now, the state of the broader economy, the commercial economy, as we all know, has been struggling. And I think that for companies that have both commercial and government business, that makes the government business that much more important. So maybe as the economy gets going here, that influence will soften. The final factor I'll mention is what I'll call the maturation of the protest process. Back in the late 80s and early 90s, when there were 3,000 protests a year, there were far fewer GAO decisions that had been issued on key areas. And I think there had been significantly less education of contracting officers and procurement personnel around some of these potential problem areas. Now we have such a greater body of knowledge and a greater body of guidance in the form of GAO decisions that we're all in a better position of predicting when a protest argument will be strong or meritorious.
Right. And Jay, that's a great point, you know, and we'll get into the particulars of the case law and what you see as key trends and decisions that can better inform, you know, decisions by both customer agencies and potential protesters in the next segment. But right now we do have to take a break. My guests today are Jay Carey and Luke Meyer. They are attorneys at McKenna, Long & Aldrich, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today my guests are Jay Carey and Luke Meyer. They are attorneys at McKenna, Long & Aldrich, and we're talking about bid protests. And you know, it's interesting. I didn't think I'd see this, but over the past year, there's been a lot of focus on prejudice and what that is in the context of a bid protest. And it is fundamental to success or failure in a bid protest, depending on whether you're the protester or the government. It's like both sides of that coin.
Yep.
So, Luke, you know, first, why don't we just go with the basics and what is prejudice in the context of a bid protest? What's that legal standard?
To prevail on a protest, you have to show two things. One, you have to show agency error. But then second, you also have to show that you were prejudiced by the error. And the way that that's applied is there's this substantial chance concept. And what you have to show is, but for the error, there was a substantial chance that you might have won the award. So in other words, you have to show there was some kind of mistake, something went wrong, but you also have to show you had a chance of winning, if not for that mistake.
And I would just add to that, you know, that when, at least when I initially read that language, that sounds like pretty high bar, substantial chance.
Right.
Likely to win, almost.
Right. And I think it's important for the listeners to understand historically, that is not how it's been interpreted for a couple of reasons. One is that there's another part of the standard that the Federal Circuit has articulated that says you only need to show a reasonable possibility of prejudice. So when you put that reasonable possibility standard together with substantial chance, it softens it. And really, if the court or GAO sees that there is a possible pathway for the protester to end up with the award of the contract, historically, in most cases, that's enough.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because it isn't one of the most effective, from a prejudice demonstration perspective, avenues to protest is on discussions or lack of meaningful discussions? Because doesn't GAO basically say, or in the past, like, well, of course, it's a reasonable possibility, substantial chance, because it never happened, so we don't know. So the benefit of the doubt goes to the protester. Is that right?
Yeah, and you'll see a lot of GAO decisions say that there's a presumption of prejudice. Oftentimes, if you're talking about discussions, and part of that is discussions are followed by new proposal submissions. So whenever you've got that opportunity to submit new proposals, it's very difficult to say how offers would have revised their bids, what would have happened. So,
how they would have been evaluated, right?
Yeah, and one of the fundamental questions with prejudice is how much can we tell about what would have happened? So, you know, if you have a protest and you find the agency should have done this one thing differently. So the question is it very easy to tell how everything would have played out if they had done that one thing differently, or is there uncertainty? And if there, the more uncertainty there is, the more likely you are to show prejudice, because that pathway for you potentially winning is there.
And the one thing I would add to that, you know, particularly to your discussion's point, is yes, there are certain arguments where GAO has a proclivity to presume prejudice. But if you are a disappointed offeror thinking about a protest, you have to recognize you can only carry that so far. So thinking about the discussions argument, even where the agency failed to conduct discussions, failed to identify a significant weakness or a deficiency, you as the protester need to be prepared to say, if they had done that, GAO, here is what I would have done. And if you don't do that, there's a real risk that GAO will say, hey, you didn't prove prejudice. So even though it didn't happen, we don't see how you're going to get to a possibility of award.
Okay. So when we talk a little bit about that more, that prejudice burden you're talking about, and how does, you know, the type of procurement play into that? I know, like, there's a lot of angst right now about protests, but also a lot of angst out there about low price technically acceptable evaluation methodology versus doing a best value, you know, from a business perspective. How does that play out from a, you know, in the legal world, when you're talking about, you know, the burden to show prejudice?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that is appealing to an agency about an LPTA procurement is it's more difficult to protest in general, and it's more difficult to demonstrate prejudice, potentially, depending where you fall in the procurement. So, you know, just again, as a general matter, the more agency discretion there is in selecting the winner, the more nuanced that is. If you show some error, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty about how things might have played out. In the LPTA, if you didn't win, you were not the lowest price, and you're protesting, you know, the pathway to prejudice can be more difficult, because if you're not lowest price, you really need to show either there's some problem with how your price was calculated or that the awardee should not have been acceptable. And the other problem you can have is either an LPTA or in other types of procurements, well, not a problem, but a challenge potentially, either an LPTA or other procurements where there's a clear ranking of offerors, you can have a prejudice challenge if you're not the next in line. So if you end up third or fourth, for example, and you only challenge the awardee, then you likely cannot show prejudice. You may not even have standing if you have not challenged offer two or three who stands ahead of you for the award.
And one other thought about LPTA, I mean, I think as you indicated, Roger, there is some angst around what at least for a while appeared to be an increased use of low price technically acceptable procurements by the government, by DOD. Anecdotally, it seems like that's tapering off and that the agencies are headed back toward best value again. That may be a function of a changing budget environment, but it may also be a function of the fact that when an agency uses an LPTA procurement, they're really binding themselves and severely limiting their discretion on the back end of the procurement. I mean, as we all know, when you have a best value procurement, you have the source selection authority who comes in at the end and makes what is a subjective, reasonable, but subjective judgment about whether the benefits of one proposal are worth the price premium. And he or she has a lot of discretion around how to make that trade-off. And so where an agency isn't sure exactly what it wants, maybe it has a complex procurement, I think it's important for the agency to have that flexibility at the back end to decide which proposal do I really like better. With a low-price technically acceptable procurement, of course, the agency doesn't have that flexibility. They've bound themselves up front that they're going with the lowest price offeror, and I think agencies aren't always thrilled with that result when they actually get to the award.
Yeah, I mean, it looks great on paper. I'm going to go with a low price, but, you know, I think, yeah, that's a great point you make about the discretion to be able to select something that represents greater value in the long run for the agency, and maybe just get to the fundamentals that, low price, technically acceptable, isn't delivering, the mission support that agencies actually need.
Right.
I mean, that could be a big part of it. So just to sort of sum up, because we've got about a minute left in this segment, but, so we have LPTA. What happens in best value? I mean, and Luke, you make the point, there's more uncertainty, there's more discretion there. So there's more, I think, opportunity, I guess, for lack of a better word, to show prejudice or to allege and be able to get somebody to buy off on it. We've already done meaningful discussions. So any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, so you could still find yourself in a very difficult prejudice situation in best value if there's a huge gap between you as the protester and the awardee. But, if you're either pretty close or if you can make some headway, you can show some mistakes, then the path is easier because, if you can show you should have had a higher rating somewhere, you should have had other strengths, it's just, it's more difficult for GAO to say, well, I'm sure that wouldn't have been enough to make a difference. Usually GAO is not going to want to step out and make that kind of a judgment if there's that possibility there that you might have been able to win if you had had a more appealing proposal.
Yeah, right. Bottom line, in best value, there are just many more pathways to be able to show prejudice than there are in LPTA.
Right. It could be misevaluation your proposal, misevaluation of the winner's proposal, lack of discussions, right?
Right. You can attack their technical evaluation and say it should have been lower. You can attack yours and say you should have been higher. You can attack the price evaluation if there's a realism evaluation that's part of that. As you say, discussions. There are just many, many more pathways to saying, to getting to a bottom line that says, hey, GAO, given the total picture of all our arguments here, if we're right on all of these arguments or even a subset of these arguments, we would have had a substantial chance of award.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And right now we have to take our last break, but we'll be back with Jay Carey and Luke Meyer. They are attorneys at McKenna, Long & Aldridge, and we'll continue our discussion of bid protests. We'll talk a little bit about organizational conflicts of interest, and maybe we'll close out talking a little bit about hearings and what they mean and what they are all about at GAO. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Jay Carey and Luke Meyer. They are attorneys at McKenna, Long & Aldridge, and we're talking about bid protests. And we're going to start this segment off talking about organizational conflicts of interest. Always very interesting, fascinating area of procurement law, regulation, and bid protests. So, Jay, what's the current state of the law? And I know there's some interesting decisions you want to talk about it. But yeah. First, where are we? I think there's this Turner Construction case that sort of, set some new parameters or, is informed thinking about that. So why don't you talk about that?
Absolutely. Thanks, Roger. So let me start actually with a little context that predates Turner. Prior to Turner, there was a very well-developed body of GAO case law and OCIs that was both robust and fairly prescriptive around what agencies had to do, what mitigation measures would work or wouldn't work for various types of OCIs. And just for our listeners, there are really three major kinds of OCIs. There's unequal access to information, there's biased ground rules, and there's impaired objectivity. And very quickly, unequal access to information is where an offeror, through means of performing some other government contract, gets access to agency source selection information or other information that gives them an unfair advantage in the procurement. Biased ground rules is where the offeror has had some role in laying the ground rules for the competition and now wants to compete in the competition.
Like writing the statement of work, right?
Yeah, or the specification, exactly. And impaired objectivity is sort of the biggest and mushiest of them. It's where the offeror has some other business interests that might impair its ability to give the government objective advice. And that was the one where, prior to Turner, there were really a very few pathways for that kind of problem to be mitigated if it existed, because GAO would impute impaired objectivity conflicts throughout the organization. So if you had an interest off in one subsidiary, it would be imputed throughout even a large organization. And GAO had also pretty clearly said that organizational separation, different management, different corporate entities, that wasn't enough.
No.
Yeah. To mitigate that. So it really narrowed the pathways for people to deal with, for offerors to deal with, and agencies to deal with that kind of OCI. That brings us to Turner and actually another case that goes along with it, Axiom, both by the Federal Circuit. And those cases made a couple of key points. Number one, in both cases, the Federal Circuit put a real emphasis on the deference due to a contracting officer who meaningfully investigates and wrestles with and comes to a conclusion about an OCI and whether it's significant and whether it's been adequately mitigated. So really put much more of an emphasis on deference than had I think existed before. The other significant thing about Turner in particular, is that it really emphasized this concept of significance, and it highlighted the fact that under the FAR, an OCI needs to be mitigated, neutralized, or avoided only if it is significant. And when you put that together with the emphasis on the contracting officer's discretion and deference to the contracting officer, we now have this new zone of elbow room or leeway that contracting officers have to make judgments about whether an OCI is significant, and to make judgments about whether, if it is significant, it's been adequately mitigated, that just didn't really exist prior to Turner.
Right. So how is that? Have you seen that now play out in other decisions?
Absolutely. I mean, just to give you kind of a highlight on that, in the last certainly two, and I think going on 3 years now. Until that one case we'll talk about in a minute, there had been not a single sustain at GAO of an OCI protest ground, and similarly, not a single ruling in favor of a protester by the Court of Federal Claims on an OCI ground for, as I said, over two and almost 3 years. Until just recently, GAO sustained an OCI argument in International Resources Group, which for those who are interested is B-409346.2. And so I, whereas prior to Turner, you had fairly...
So what did they sustain that on what did they object to? What was the result, I guess, from the sustain?
Excellent question. So bottom line, in International Resources, you had a contracting officer who GAO concluded hadn't really meaningfully wrestled with the real facts on the ground. And GAO concluded there were hard facts evidencing a potential OCI that the CO had never dealt with. So I'll give you a little bit more detail about the case. It was a situation where the agency was USAID. There was a former government official at the agency who had oversight for the procurement, who, after initial proposals were submitted, left USAID and went to work for AECOM, who was the awardee. And the former government official did everything above board. As soon as he started talking to the awardee, he gave notice and he recused himself. But prior to that point, as I said, he'd had oversight for the development of the statement of work and how the procurement was being run. And for one reason or another, contracting officer never looked at that situation or assessed it prior to awarding the contract, only looked at it after the protest was filed. Now, as both GAO and the Court of Federal Claims have both said, that in and of itself is not a problem. A contracting officer may look at OCIs after a protest has been filed. That's what the contracting officer here did, and the CO concluded that the former government official had no involvement with the procurement after delegating at a very early stage. But there were there was a universe of emails that were produced in the course of the GAO protest, and GAO could tell from those emails that the former government official had participated in drafting the statement of work, had continued to have high-level input into the direction of the procurement after that point. And so GAO concluded, hey, you know, contracting officer, there are some hard facts here that evidence
that
a real problem that
you never
dealt with.
Right.
And as a potential protester, if you're thinking about an OCI protest argument, that's really the core of what you need. You would need some problem that the contracting officer didn't meaningfully investigate.
Yeah, and there's a government lesson in that too, which is because the contracting officer is afforded such deference, it's much better to acknowledge the full extent of the problematic facts and say, I see it all, but I'm okay with it. Because then that probably will be okay if you're given a great deal of deference. But the risk is if the contracting officer seems to have not acknowledged or kind of mistakenly sized up the situation, then there's the potential problem and the kind of thing that you could still prevail on an OCI protest.
Right. And so, but in that case, what if now the CEO went back and said, okay, I was mistaken. Now I've looked at all these stuff and I still don't think it's a problem. Was that avenue still available after the sustain, or is it something where they said, nah, you can't go, you can't keep, you don't get you only get so many do-overs. Right?
Oh, I think in that case, GAO left the contracting officer to
go back and do it again.
Do a meaningful investigation. Although, you know, as a practical matter in that situation where you have a former government official who joins the awardee, and one other key fact I should have mentioned earlier is that the former government official then helped the awardee prepare its final proposal.
Okay.
So there was no firewall. There was
okay.
no mitigation. There was no nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of once the cat's out of the bag on that one, and I think it would make it very difficult for the contracting officer to get to the point of concluding that there's no problem there. I mean,
right.
Clearly I'm jumping to a conclusion there, but it's a difficult path.
That makes it more difficult. Absolutely. Yeah. So was there a hearing in that case?
I don't believe so.
Okay. That it sounds like it could be all done on the record. Absolutely. And we got about a minute left. So, you know, just so, and I promised the listeners we talk about hearings for just a minute. So we do, there's about 4-5% hearings every year. Why so few? And is that a good thing, bad thing?
Yeah. So it's an interesting question. And let me just note at the outset that historically, the percentages haven't been that low. 5 years ago, there were hearings in 10% of all protests. And if you go back further than that, I think it was generally hovering 10 to 12%. So it's really in the last 2 to 3 years where the percentage of cases in which there is a hearing has really dropped. This year, most recent year, fiscal year 2014, it was 4.7%. In 2013, it was 3.4%. So it's really a marked drop in the last few years. Why is that? Well, again, I look to that effectiveness rate, the 43%, and the fact that that's remained where it has, while the percentage of sustains at GAO has dropped. That tells me that agencies are taking more corrective action, and I think at least part of what's going on here is that they are taking corrective action in cases that would otherwise go to a hearing.
Right. And when it goes to a hearing, that's generally
not
a good sign for the government.
The
right.
I mean,
yeah.
Generally, GAO will ask for a hearing once the record has been fully developed, and where GAO continues to see a hole in the record, or it wants to give the agency
one last chance.
And I think in the great majority of instances where GAO calls for a hearing, that's a red flag to the agency. And I've seen cases where agencies have taken corrective action directly in response to GAO's request for a hearing.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, we do have to wrap up the show. I want to thank my guests today, Jay Carey and Luke Meyer. They are attorneys McKenna Long and Aldridge, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.